Being the last session of the day is always going to be a little bit of a challenge. So it's great to see a number of you still here. We're here as a full panel. We want to make it as lively and as interesting as possible, and also to encourage you really to ask questions and interact. And maybe because it's the last panel, you'll feel more able to do that. It's on a hugely important topic of safety and security. A safe pair of hands, how can cities be secure hosts? And you know, for my own journey in the business of sport, I would definitely say I'm not a safety and security expert, but in everything that I've been involved in, from the English Premier League to UEFA, to working with many different bid cities and host cities, and of course, as Jean-François Martin made clear this morning, most recently the Euros, if they're not safe and secure, nothing else works. So it's pretty well a fundamental to everything to do with both bidding and hosting. And today we want to try not only look at the expertise on the panel and their own engagement in making safe and secure environments, but also to do a little bit of forecasting as to events ahead of us. What are the new challenges that come in relation to safety and security, whether it be the increasing development of live sites and fan zones, whether it be the risk posed by cybersecurity. So let's try and have a very open and hopefully quite informed discussion. To welcome our guests, immediately to my right is Karen Eyre-White, who's the Chief Executive of the Sports Ground Safety Authority, so the regulator for granting safety certificates to major sports venues. Next is Dr. Moussa Goumeidi, who's the Deputy City Manager of Durban City Council, in charge of community and emergency services, and of course heavily involved in the preparations for the Durban Commonwealth Games. Then Bernard Higgins, who's the Assistant Chief Constable, Police Scotland, and therefore because of the number of events Scotland have been hosting, has got a wide range of experience, including most recently on the safe standing at Celtic Park, which is an important part of the debate currently in the UK. And then finally, Patrick Vajda, who is a sports and events consultant with Marsh, and he's an expert in risk analysis and risk assessment. So we're going to kick off with Karen. And I just want each of the speakers to say a few words about themselves and the work they're involved in, and perhaps highlight some of the issues that they think are relevant on safety and security. So, Karen.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. So the Sports Ground Safety Authority, for those of you who don't know us, we are a government body. We regulate spectator safety in football in England and Wales. We also provide advice and guidance to event organisers and others on creating safe events and enjoyable events for spectators. And we write the Green Guide, which is an international guide which is used as the standard for safety internationally. Three things for me to start off with. Firstly, it's always absolutely essential for us on projects that we're working on that we are making them safe and secure without compromising on atmosphere and excitement. And we've heard a little bit about that today and how important that atmosphere is and creating those social moments. And actually, it's really important for us that safety isn't something that stops that. It's actually something that enables it. And we're always very clear that that's what we're trying to do. Secondly, for me, creating a safe event is about engaging spectators, fans, whatever you want to call the people who are coming to your event, in a really positive way. And what we refer to is safety, security, and service. And we never forget about that final S, because actually, if you engage people positively and get them on board, you're at least half the way there. And actually, you know, the vast majority of fans that come to events to enjoy the sport can be encouraged to self-manage in terms of safety, to self-police, to do all these things that you really need to have a successful event. So the second thing for me is about really positive engagement. And then the third thing, sort of a hot topic at the moment, is about the difference between safety and security and actually the overlap between the two. And we've always seen these terms as quite separate. So safety, which is our area of expertise, around, you know, the environment that you create for spectators, how you keep people safe, crowd movement, you know, those types of issues. And on the other hand, security being about criminal activity, public disorder, the counter-terrorism threat. I think what we're seeing is those two worlds coming much closer together, and actually that overlap between safety and security becoming really important. So as an example of that, Security measures such as screening, bag searches actually can have safety implications. You don't want to create large queues that then cause you issues with crowd movement. So actually understanding those two and how they interact, I think, is really important.
Thank you. Musa, from a South Africa and Durban perspective, tell us a little bit about your work and in particular, obviously, the challenges that are with you at the moment in terms of preparing for the Commonwealth Games.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We're pleased to be here. We're a delegation from Durban. We have been lucky in the past in that we have been able to host quite a lot of events, major events. From the first event in 1995, when the Rugby World Cup took place in South Africa, we've always participated in major events. After that, you may be aware that we hosted the first international AIDS conference we hosted in the African continent in the year 2000. Also, we were able to host that quite successfully as the city. A lot of events, non-aligned movement, and a lot of others. Currently, in the past 6 months, we've hosted again. After 2010, obviously everyone knows about 2010, we're able to host a successful International AIDS Conference again in 2016. And now we're preparing for 2022 for the Commonwealth Games hosting. The cluster I represent has two arms. The first arm is the one that looks after arts and culture, sports and recreation in the city. We look after stadia, we look after making sure that we host as many events as possible. We develop a lot of programs for the city that are linked to our culture, linked to our heritage as well. That's one arm. Then we have the second arm where it's a safety and security arm. That arm involves security, involves disaster management, fire, security, in safer cities as well, and health. It has a bit of regulatory and an enforcement part. That is what we, I think this conversation will focus on a lot. Using that element, what we usually do is participate from the bidding process up to the delivery stage of each of those events. Preparations, we make sure that we coordinate all spheres of government, the private sector, including the non-governmental organizations, before we lodge our bid, so that during that process all the issues are identified, so that once the bid is lodged, we have covered a lot of those issues, and once we go to delivery stage, those are taken care of. So that's in a nutshell is what we do, but we'll give you details afterwards.
Thank you. Bernard, you know, one of the things very striking about Glasgow and Scotland is the number of major sporting events that you do host. I know that's your area of responsibility. Tell us a bit about your work and some of the challenges you've been facing.
Yeah, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Bernie Higgins, Assistant Chief from Police Scotland. Part of my portfolio is I'm responsible for all events and sporting matters that occur in Scotland. So a very quick plotted history. I was heavily involved in the delivery of the Ryder Cup. I also took command within the Commonwealth Games, the Scottish Independence Referendum, more recently the two Open Golf Championships in Scotland. And I've also been part of the bid, which has seen Scotland successfully secure the Solheim Cup in 2019 and the Euro Football Championships in 2020, and currently planning for the European Sports Championships, which will be co-hosted between Glasgow and Berlin in 2018. As Mike says, there's been a real avalanche of massive events that have landed right across Scotland, in fairness, because whilst the Commonwealth Games was predominantly based in Glasgow, we also had sites in Dundee, in Edinburgh and various other places. Some of the challenges we've seen is really around safety and security in the changing picture. You know, so for example, 2 weeks before the Ryder Cup, the threat level changed from substantial to severe, which means that an attack is highly likely. And that's the space that we've been operating in ever since then. But I guess the learning from the Ryder Cup was around contingencies, and whatever event that you plan for, you plan for it for that moment in time, but you should always be asking is, well, what happens if the threat level goes up? So right now, for example, any event that we are planning for, and we police roughly about 12,000 events per year across Scotland, we're always looking at the contingency. What happens if? And right now it's what happens if it moves to critical. And for those that don't know, critical means an attack is imminent. And I guess the final thing I would say is that, you know, Paris last year with the attack at the Bataclan, the attack on the Stade de France, it changed everything in terms of how you need to think about how you plan for the safety and security of your event.
Thank you. And finally, to complete our panel is Patrick Vajda. Patrick comes from a different end of the industry, which is he's a man who helps assess your risks and works particularly with host committees and also with cities. So, Patrick, tell us a little bit about how you assess risk and how you then help people implement action.
I am not sure to be able to answer because it's top secret.
There are some journalists in the room, but you know, Chatham House rules, you're fine.
First of all, I would like to apologize for my accent, which is not Scottish, which is not English, just only French.
It's lovely French.
Thank you. Yes, risk management is certainly a little broader than only security and safety, even if security and safety is now, I can say, much more than important. We are working on three areas in particular when we work for sport events, which are the risk which has an impact on human life, on money, which means the budget, and also on timing. So when we work, for example, on Beijing 2008, after a long mission of 3 years and 3 years and a half, we found out around 700 risks. But only 100 or 120 has an impact on the event itself. So we have to work, first of all, to make the complete risk analysis to find everything. And after that, we have to select the risk which has an impact on the three pillars I already told you. And so at the end of the day, we found around 100-110 risks, and we have to work only to find solution on these 100 or 120, 120 risk. I think that the risk analysis, which is the beginning of the job, is much more than important. We have to look at the risk. We have to look in front of the risk. It's the only solution to avoid the risk. I remember a long, long time ago, an old man who was a president of something. I cannot tell you what, but perhaps in private I can explain. This gentleman told me something like, never look at the risk, because if you look at the risk, you will produce the risk, which is absolutely the reverse of the reality.
Thank you. I discovered in our prep that Patrick has a load of secret stories, so by all means probe him in the Q&A and see what you get out of him. So we've established, I think, the expertise of the panel from a number of different dimensions, and I thought what might be useful is for each of them to give us an example of what they regard as best practice, so some real working models where they think safety and security has been planned for, designed in, thought about, and produced good results. So some best practice ideas. First of all, Karen.
I'll talk a little bit about London 2012. So we were quite heavily involved in that. We had somebody seconded over to LOCOG to work on safety planning. And for me, three things again. I like my threes. I think, first of all, I think the supporter engagement was great, the spectator engagement. We had games makers. We had people being very proactively in the crowd, talking to them about all of the issues that they needed to talk to them about, and that included safety. And that just meant that actually those conversations were much easier. They understood why we were asking them to do things, and I think it really helped make the whole thing a lot more smooth. Secondly, On London 2012, I think, is around sort of joint working, integrated working, collaboration. We've heard quite a lot of those terms. When it comes to planning for safety, it's absolutely essential. There are lots of different partners involved. There'll be the organiser, the venue operator, the police, the other kind of blue light services, and actually getting that integrated in a planning phase, but also in an operational phase, understanding your command and control structures, having a consistent approach across venues to safety management. So making sure actually all of the operations manuals are consistent so that if during the games you have an issue, you can mobilise resources much more easily because, for example, all of the venues are using the same code words. You know, it's simple things, but actually if you get that wrong, it really can cause an issue in an emergency. And then thirdly, I think what London 2012 did was start to kind of popularise this concept of the last mile and this area between the transport hub and the venue and getting the management of that right and that being a really important part of getting the operation of your venue right because, of course, that's about how people are getting their flow rates, making sure that people are arriving perhaps at staggered times. So that integration with transport, I think, was something that really started to be explored in London 2012 and was really successful.
Thank you. Musa, what would be your example of best practice you've been involved in?
We, as I indicated earlier, that we host a lot of events. From the beginning, when you bid, you need to understand the event that you are going to be hosting. We host a lot of outdoor events as well as a lot of indoor events as well. We recently hosted an indoor event, but which had the same capacity as an outdoor event. A 20,000 conference within an indoor arena. So the plans there require you to understand the venue, as Karen has just indicated, understand the participants as well who are going to be there. This event had a lot of heads of states, including Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General. So the level of involvement of the police much earlier is critical in such events. Understanding the routes that are going to be used, basically setting up streams well ahead of time before you even lodge. Understand if you have such an event, these are the likelihoods that are going to be there, these are the likely people are going to attend, what type of audience are you going to attract. Such an event like the AIDS, I'm talking here about the International AIDS Conference, wherever it's been held, there are protesters, and it's part of the culture of the conference that when it is held, there will be people who will come and put their points of view across in either because they want certain things to be done either in against the drug companies or some other forms of research. So you need to pre-understand the events that you are going to host so that your plans speak to what is expected to happen during those events. If you are hosting 20,000 people, you need to be aware whether as a city you have capacity to actually accommodate those people. So before you even lodge that bid document, understand where they're going to stay, the routes, do they need security along those routes, the environment where they're going to stay. All those nitty-gritties are critical so that once we produce that bid document, and the plans for that conference, you've taken all the considerations around that conference. So the risk, as the gentleman on my right has indicated, can go up quite fast from an event that you think is going to be an easy event to a critical event because of the people that are going to be attending that event and the issues that are topical at the time. If people at that time are asking for free access to certain things, let's say medication in this case, you suddenly are going to have a lot of groups coming to protest at that. So whereas the event itself may not be high risk, but around the event, you suddenly have to improve security and safety around that event. So those are some of the nitty-gritties I think you need to consider before you put that document across to the organizers.
And did the convention go off without incident? Was it successful?
I think if Mr. Blatter was around, he would say 9 out of 10, or 10 out of 10.
Okay, that's good. Bernard, what about a good example of best practice for you?
Yeah, a couple of things just to build on what Karen said there. Get in early, come and speak to us as soon as you know you're going to have your event. You can't start to engage with the police in as early as possible. And that's for two reasons. Firstly, we will give you an intelligence readout and we'll give you an assessment of what type of event we think you've got. But also, equally as importantly, it clarifies who's responsible for what really, really early. I don't own any event. I support the event organiser in delivering a safe event, but the risk rests with the event organiser. I'm responsible for the policing side of the operation, and I'll take responsibility for that. But ultimately, it's not for me to say, yeah, no event can go ahead. You also agree critical points, you know, so for all the big ones that I've done, Ryder Cup, Open Golf, we agree with the event organiser, what is the critical point when the police will step in and actually take command and control of an event? Now, fortunately, it's never had to happen because you can imagine that threshold is pretty high. And I guess the final thing for me is test and exercise. Have a really robust test and exercise regime in advance of your event. An example I'll cite, Open Golf at St Andrews in 2015. We tested and exercised about a month and a half before the event. The scenarios were severe weather, a terrorist threat, and a stand collapse due to a drone flying into it. What happened at the Open Golf? Severe weather. It was the first time in 25 years that the Open Golf went to an extra day's play. We did have a terrorist threat directed at the Open Golf, and there was damage to one of the stands during the course of the event. So everything that we tabletopped a month and a half before the actual event occurred. So can't emphasise that enough. Also understand the roles and responsibilities of each partner agency and get in early and start speaking with the police about what the effect you want the police to deliver.
Thank you. Patrick, in terms of risk assessment, what's for you the best example of an organising committee or a host city that has really looked at its risks and had that as a part of their analysis from very early on?
It's a difficult question because the risk analysis depends, first of all, on the size of the event, but also depends where the event takes place. I love the sentence pronounced by you, I think, to understand the events. What means to understand the events? It means that we have to interview all the projects which are able to do the events, to create the events. Just for the Olympics, for example, the Summer Olympics represent a minimum of 67 different projects. So we have absolutely to understand each of these 67 projects in order to be able to analyze each risk. We are not a specialist of everything. We are not a specialist of 67 different projects, such as Olympic Village, such as transportation, and so on. But because of our history, because what we have done in the past, we are able to compare what could happen in the next event, which was already happened with the past event. And for example, I was in front of the transportation manager of the Atlanta Games, who was before the CEO of the company in charge of the public transportation in Atlanta. So certainly he knew transport in Atlanta much better than me. Nevertheless, because we are able to explain to him some problems we have in the past games, we create new, new image for him, and he was able to analyze totally differently the risk of the games and the traditional risk of public transportation in Atlanta. We have to do this risk analysis or this interview for each of the 67, 68 projects in order to understand everything. And just to finish about this particular question, when you have 67 projects during the first year of the preparation of the event, each project are working alone, more or less alone. So the connection between the event will take place a little later. So it means that, for example, with the police, we will not work during the three first year with the police. We will work with the police or the firemen or the medical system or the public hospital system later. And sometimes, I remember one event I have in my mind, sometimes it's too late because it's sometimes, very difficult to work with public people when you are working for a private company or for a private organizing committee. Perhaps we have something like that also in the 2010 in South Africa.
Just moving on, the final sort of round of questions from me, and looking at the sort of changing face and the changing environment for mega sporting events. And I'm thinking here, obviously, about the rise of the global threat of international terrorism, and yet the development at the same time of live sites, celebration environments, fan zones. I think the increasing risk that's been identified in terms of cyber sabotage and hacking and so on. So just maybe from each of the panelists to say a little word or two about relevant areas of the new environment and how that has become a part of preparing for and delivering safety and security in this global and changing world. Karen.
Yeah, I mean, I think that fan zones are really interesting. We're seeing a growth in them, as we referenced earlier in the day. You know, often these are bigger than your biggest venue in terms of capacity and numbers. And actually, what's really important, I think, is to recognise and realise that and to treat it as a venue and to have a full operations plan, understand what your capacity is, even though that can be very difficult for something that is free and that you don't necessarily ticket. So treating it like a venue, understanding how you secure the perimeter, understanding what your capacity is, understanding as well kind of the human nature. And this is almost more important in a more free-moving zone than in a stadium. You know, what happens if somebody lets a pyrotechnic off in the middle of that? Actually, you've got your immediate safety issue, the fact you've got a pyro that's gone off. You've also got your human reaction to that, where they won't know it's a pyro. And they will react as you would expect someone to react if they're in a crowded area and they think that there might be something more sinister happening. So it's about... coming back to risk management, it's about doing that analysis of risk, understanding what your mitigations are. But also, I think, just to build on what Patrick was saying, actually, you know, absolutely essential to plan really far out in a joint collaborative way, absolutely essential to get all your risks right. You've also got to prepare yourself to make some quick risk assessments in the moment. And yeah, that's what we call dynamic risk assessments. So this is about making sure that you've got the right people in the right places with the right kind of decision-making authority to make some really quite difficult but quick decisions when they're needed. And I think in the context of things like fan zones, actually, that's really important.
Yeah, we heard this morning about the success of the fan zones in the Euro Championships. And they were being staged, obviously, against a backdrop of what had actually been terrorist acts in Paris and France, and the level of analysis that went on and the level of stakeholder liaison and discussion before finally going ahead with those fan zones was massive. In the end, because of the way it was put together, the way in which all the security forces were engaged, these mag and bag environments that were created around the fan zone environments, they were a huge success with an incident. But you've got to do a lot of risk analysis before you make that final decision. Mm. If you get it right, it's worth it because it becomes a part of the joy of a mega event experience. Musa, what about for you in South Africa and Durban in terms of this changing environment? What new challenges have you faced?
Yeah, in 2010, the fan zones or fan parks, as we call them, emerged for many reasons. One, we wanted those people who couldn't afford the price of a ticket also to have access to the games, and secondly, we wanted to spread the games to as far away places as possible. So we created fan parks even in communities which were far away from the actual venue of the event. But luckily for us, for those who've been in Durban would know that between the 25th of December and the 1st of January every year, we have about 500,000 people on our beaches per day. In a single day between those dates, you have 500,000 people on the beach. So these plans, which we had to implement during the World Cup fan parks, were plans that we already were utilizing to manage those situations. Basically, what we do is, because we don't have the sophistication of high-tech, things like cyber, you know, ID, identification online, registration of people to attend those events. We rely a lot on physical security, and secondly, on technology that is overhead CCTV cameras, and Menenberg, those types, and also on area, you know, management of the precinct. So what we would do is the whole precinct would be earmarked for the event, and access to that precinct would be restricted to vehicles mostly, so that people can come in, and those that are staying within that precinct would have some form of identification so that they are able to come in and out without any hindrance. But any other vehicle would not be given access to that precinct. And then you start from there, that is at least a half a kilometer away from the actual fan park or from the actual area where you have a lot of people. And using that area management, you start closer, as you come closer and closer to the event, you have different levels of security people go through until the actual event, where there is absolutely free access through all the activities within that event. But security starts from the periphery and closer in, and within that periphery you have security also mingling with the people, either uniformed or non-uniformed, and you also have an eye in the sky, you know, monitoring the area, and they have restriction on certain things like alcohol, fireworks and all such that may cause problems, bottles and all those things within. But obviously there could be improvement with the introduction of technology. You could, if you wanted to do so, you know, register those people who want to come in. But at the moment, we are monitoring and giving free access to people to come in, but just improving, you know, the levels of security for people who want to be within those precincts.
Thank you. Bernard, obviously a changing world from global terrorism to safe standing, which has been piloted here in Glasgow at Celtic Park. Perhaps you'd say a word or two about what you see as the challenges of this changing environment.
Well, firstly, in terms of terrorism, I mean, I don't want to go over what everyone is very well aware of, but the reality is various terrorist groups have legitimised targeting events in public crowded places because they're easy targets. And again, you saw that in Paris last year, where they targeted the theatre as well as the Parc de France, and then moved on into the city centre and targeted the cafes. So very much when